Martin, docente al Politecnico di Torino, nonché curatore di questa Biennale Tecnologie insieme a Luca De Biase. E sono qui con grande piacere per presentarvi un ospite di eccezione su temi di cui mi sono occupato, mi occupo ormai da molti anni, ovvero David Lyon. Il professor David Lyon, direttore del Centro di Studi sulla Sorveglianza della Queen's University di Kingston, in Ontario, in Canada. Che si è formato all'Università di Brantford nel Regno Unito, studiando il fenomeno della sorveglianza sin dagli anni Ottanta. Rimarco questo aspetto perché è un vero piacere avere il professor Lyon con noi, perché ha visto degli sviluppi della nostra società sicuramente con grandissimo anticipo rispetto alla maggior parte degli altri osservatori, ed abbiamo l'aspetto di avere una prospettiva di lungo periodo sul tema della sorveglianza, su cui lui ha scritto moltissime cose, ha pubblicato libri, articoli definiti pionieristici, tradotti in molte lingue, a partire dall'occhio elettronico del 1994, o per arrivare a un'epoca più recente, la cultura della sorveglianza del 2018, pubblicato anche in Italia dalla Lewis University Press, e sta lavorando sempre sul tema della sorveglianza a una brevissima introduzione. Coordinato a progetti di ricerca, il suo lavoro è stato riconosciuto anche con premi e onorificenze. Il tema della sorveglianza è uno dei temi cruciali della contemporaneità ed è anche uno dei temi essenziali di Biennale Tecnologia. E quindi con particolare piacere che do il benvenuto al professor Lyon, lo ringrazio per il tempo che ci dedicherà oggi e gli passo il microfono ricordandoci che abbiamo complessivamente un'ora e che verso la fine prenderemo alcune domande da parte dell'audience e le porrò io stesso al professor Lyon. Grazie molto, professore, il microfono a lei.
Buonasera, sono felice di essere qui, ma mi dispiace di non parlare italiano. Tuttavia, un gentile interprete via Utera potrebbe anche migliorare il mio discorso. Thank you for your kind invitation. I'm delighted to join you, although I wish I was actually in Torino. I would like to dedicate the lecture to the memory of my friend Stefano Rodotà. I want to say three things this evening. One, that COVID-19 creates a context of contagion, affecting all aspects of life. It prompts surveillance, both obvious devices such as drones and wearables, and less visible data systems for public health. Such tech solutions, as I would call them, are common, but not always welcomed. They carry risks. Two, these surveillance tech solutions affect and are understood by groups differently in everyday life. They're mediated by what I call cultures of surveillance. That is, the attitudes and the habits that we all form around surveillance today. Some people respond to this with compliance. Others are quite critical. The third thing I want to say is that cultures of surveillance are not fixed. They are in flux. People in one culture or another of surveillance may care about data protection and privacy. But beyond this, they may also seek fairness as a possible goal. So I want to conclude by saying that grassroots movements for data justice may mitigate the negative effects of surveillance, including pandemic surveillance. The year 2020 will be remembered for a long time for the ways in which it was a first year of the global pandemic of coronavirus, known as COVID-19. Many millions of lives altered course during this year as the contagion caught hold and tightened its grip. The contagion affected all aspects of life, and no one was or is immune. You know about it in Italy, I do in Canada. One prominent feature of the pandemic is the way that it has prompted numerous surveillance initiatives. Most obvious among these is this proliferation of contact tracing apps, around the world, intended to track the spread of the virus and to warn others if they have been close to someone who is infected with the virus. These warnings allow participants to get themselves tested and, if necessary, to self-isolate or seek medical help. Such contact tracing is highly surveillant, dependent as it is on the use of location tracking and on the use of many items of personal data that circulate as a result of our use of the internet. In China, for example, the Alipay app, which is authorized by the state council, uses a green, yellow, red color-coded health pass for citizens, based on both active data, self-reported symptoms, one's address, one's identification, and passive data such as GPS location. The green pass is low risk for COVID-19 and offers relative freedom of movement for the user. But if the pass becomes yellow, then mandatory quarantine must be observed, and other surveillance, such as drones, may be used to check on you, while red means medical isolation and treatment. In India, the Arogya Setu app was also launched as a compulsory tool, mandatory for government workers first and then for the wider population. It was more rapidly adopted in India than the Pokemon Go app. But at least one state, Kerala, objected that the app was needlessly coercive and deprived people of their civil liberties. Singapore, one of the first countries to use contact tracing, it's called Trace Together, based its development on public health criteria, and its use was voluntary. But the take-up rate was far below the recommended 60% required to be useful on a large scale. And in every case, much personal data is involved, frequently far more data than is strictly necessary. But contact tracing is just one of many pandemic surveillance developments. Other very visible ones include the use of drones for policing quarantine and self-isolation. But surveillance has also expanded in other areas too, such as the use of wearable devices for those working from home. You see me today working from home in my home in Kingston, Ontario. I'm not wearing a wearable, by the way. And novel modes of checking on those who are attending school. But much less visibly, but no less consequentially, data systems for public health have been massively augmented. Their expansion has often been fast-tracked as a means of trying to coordinate efforts for slowing down the spread of the pandemic, or as it is put, flattening the curve. In my own province of Ontario, a new health data system has been developed to detect, plan, and respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. It links high-level computing power with large health data sets that are integrated to allow for deeper knowledge of epidemiological trends, new forms of clinical insights, and treatment innovations. But as with all such projects, especially ones that use sensitive health data, surveillance requires new levels of transparency and oversight from genuinely independent bodies. Technical experts alone will not do. There has to be involvement from users and from civil society groups. After all, the users of such systems also have to remember that social factors play a large role in who is affected by COVID-19. Those in poverty, for instance, are much more likely to be negatively affected by the pandemic. It isn't a question of data privacy alone, but also the ways in which data systems can be blind to social inequalities that too must be borne in mind. The production of such tax solutions is commonplace, especially in times of crisis, such as following terrorist attacks or during political instability. 9/11 provided much evidence for this, with digital technology proposals starting very early and debates continuing for well over a decade. The Snowden revelations in 2013 indicated dramatically just how much the surveillance landscape of the US and its intelligent allies, the so-called Five Eyes, had been transformed. Big data soon became the watchword of security, surveillance, and intelligence. But if the early 20th century terrorist threats catalyzed a huge expansion of government surveillance, then the pandemic is already overtaking that. Even the rather unemotional magazine, The Economist, warned in March 2020 about the challenges of what it called a new coronopticon. In other words, the coronavirus could stimulate the growth of another all-seeing place, like Jeremy Bentham's automated surveillance in the Panopticon, dating back to 1791. Acknowledging the vast network of computers that make for convenience, entertainment, connection, and security, they might help against the virus, said The Economist. But it also observed, and I quote, that it provides a network of sensors that can coordinate the responses of both individuals and whole populations to a degree unimaginable in any previous pandemic. Countries are learning how to make use of that panopticon's power in a pell-mell, piecemeal way. The systems they lash together may last a long time. It would be best, said The Economist, to keep an eye on them. In other words, they were saying the watchers clearly need to be watched. But a problem here is just the inscrutability of exactly those practices of data collection, analysis, and use, as well as the construction of the algorithms which produce the relevant data. And it is not just the making of the mysterious codes themselves that is a problem. It's also the case that computer professionals often dissociate their work from its real life context. In other words, computer professionals all too often think of their work as being merely technical and beyond the world of ethics and politics. And yet, as we've just seen, the work that they do, the codes they construct, have impacts on the very life chances and choices of ordinary people in everyday life, people like you and me. So tech solutions actually mediate surveillance in significant ways and may either lose sight of or exacerbate the initial problem or both. Surveillance always makes people visible in specific ways, whether it uses video cameras or smartphones, and represents them and treats them according to their own criteria, standards that may not be recognized or accepted by those affected by the surveillance. Many people think that because it's their personal information, that they might be at risk. But what data systems know is not you, but your data double, your data self. You wouldn't recognize this person. But of course, that data self, those collected records about you, can come back to haunt you. When airport security systems, for example, prevent children from flying, it's their data self which is the problem. But because of how they are represented, that is how they will be treated. You can't board this flight. So let me turn to the question of critical and compliant responses within surveillance cultures. It's not only the operations of surveillance in areas such as contact tracing apps or very large-scale public health infrastructures, but also the experiences of surveillance, which are significant here. Why? Because we live in a time of user-generated content, the product of Web 2.0 originally. But that online participation of ordinary users is also what emits constant data clouds of what was first described as data exhaust. Tech giant Google learned how to monetize those data and thus how to profit from the participation of everyday users, marking the rapid rise of surveillance capitalism, which is now associated with the name of Shoshana Zuboff. Surveillance is done by some, then, and it affects others, the vast majority, in myriad ways. Most importantly, the algorithms developed by both government and by corporate bodies both create and exacerbate social divisions and differences. Notoriously, so-called predictive policing can easily become a means of reinforcing already existing prejudices and inequalities within policing practices. So in the end, due to the inadequate collecting, curating, and analysis of the data, this means that automating policing also automates inequality. Those affected are all too knowledgeable about this, and it affects the ways that they, that is, we, think about and respond to surveillance. But in the COVID-19 context, paralleling predictive policing, we find a drive for what you might call predictive public health, which is in similar danger of promoting and inflating social inequalities, especially when there is a rush to find adequate means of reducing the impact of the pandemic. Gaps in the data used by scientists and policymakers are often caused by the fact that certain population groups, think of low-wage workers, migrants, the elderly, and so on. These groups are already less visible. This is why Lynette Taylor argues for an ethics of care instead of the utilitarian calculations based on how many people that a country or a province could lose through death. Data science and policy should not just look at the majority, but what Lynette Taylor calls the mosaic of different vulnerabilities. Ordinary people in their homes are all too aware of the ways that surveillance affects them, not only in the pandemic, but before any pandemic began. We know that we are relatively privileged, and when we're not. Those affected by surveillance are aware from watching the news, or maybe from watching TV shows like Black Mirror, or reading Dave Eggers' novel, The Circle. And I'm sure there are similar items in Italy too. And their responses will depend on their positions within what I call a culture of surveillance. There is usually a whole spectrum of responses, from, on the one hand, easy compliance through to quite critical resistance, with many positions in between. So compliance is at one end of this spectrum. For many reasons, especially in a pandemic, surveillance is accepted. People are worried and fearful for the future, which may well incline them to welcome new tools for protecting themselves. They want to get back to seeing friends, to eating together, and to engaging in what used to be thought of as normal activities. In Canada, for example, with a population of only 37.5 million, more than 5 million of our COVID alert app and have been uploaded in just a few weeks. It's easy to download an app. People may also comply not only with external COVID-19 surveillance measures, but by carrying out their own informal no-tech surveillance, watching others in public places and showing disapproval when they're not wearing masks, for example. This may spill over into becoming informers, state informers, telling tales on others at the behest of government authorities in places like the UK, who don't seem to be aware, people that is, who don't seem to be observing quarantines or who have more people in a home than the official limit permits. So that's compliance. Critical approaches also exist. When people doubt what they are told by new digital measures against the pandemic, a lot depends on how much citizens trust governments and major corporations. And of course, the question of trust is central. It's of vital importance. But some also question why individuals are made responsible for their own fate. We must upload those contact tracing apps and so on, when testing sites and treatment centers are woefully underfunded, or when publicly funded residential care homes for the elderly turn out to be hot spots for COVID-19 outbreaks and deaths. So these are all examples of the culture of surveillance, now magnified in pandemic times. I now want to turn to my last area of consideration, that of demanding data justice. Cultures of surveillance are in flux, especially during a pandemic. People are tired of COVID conditions in general, and those who have been directly hit by the pandemic are especially impatient to move forward and into a new normal. Many place their hope in the development of vaccines, and when they feel that they can trust them, in government-initiated digital means to combat the pandemic. For the present, they may see hopeful signs in the development of improved public health surveillance, or in those highly surveillant contact tracing apps. And they just have to trust that the authorities are taking appropriate measures to protect their privacy. However, well before COVID-19, some British researchers, Helen Kennedy in particular, showed that growing numbers of people, when questioned about their expectations and hopes for digital devices and systems, said they were looking for fairness and not just privacy and data protection. So clearly there is a sense yet to be more fully explored that people feel uneasy about the different ways that they are treated through their online connections. People are definitely not all treated the same. And certainly if we look around the world at the many situations where COVID-19 has hit, surveillance systems have made people visible in particular ways. How they are represented and treated is often very unfair. Think of stigmatizing words like super spreader, or the ways in which people who were considered to appear Asian were associated with the pandemic's origins in Wuhan, China. Unfortunately, much COVID-19 surveillance tends to compound historical discrimination against visible minorities and other vulnerable groups. This is true in many places, but especially true of situations such as Palestine, where the contact tracing system was put in the hands of Shin Bet, the Israeli security agency, whose regular task is to contain the terrorism imputed to Palestinians. So I ask, are there other ways forward that recognize the social effects of surveillance? Of course, privacy and data protection can be defined and have been defined in ways that include, very importantly, their social, their public, and their common good aspects. And I welcome those such developments. But faced with the growing pace of surveillance developments, I believe that we need to look beyond such initiatives. What dissatisfied groups could do to help develop would be to find grassroots movements, to set up grassroots movements for data justice. And if so, this could help to mitigate negative effects of pandemic as well as other kinds of surveillance. Data justice demands fairness in how people are made visible, represented, and treated. I'm not going to say a lot about it this evening. I can leave it to you, and if anybody wants references to this, they can easily find my contact details online, and I'm happy to send you some references if that would be helpful. The growth of cultures of surveillance around the world means that people are increasingly familiar with the digital technologies and aware that their online activities have effects in the real world and vice versa. Indeed, even the old distinction between online and offline that we used to make back in the 90s and the early part of the 21st century makes less and less sense today. We are on life. We live on the internet, primarily through our phones, now used by more than half the global population. We make connections with distant others. And the platforms through which we connect also connect us with myriad other players who can influence our lives by the way the data that they collect are analyzed and used. So in this situation, seeking data justice makes much sense. The kinds of groups that could make a big difference include democratically inclined activists who are also tech savvy. They are people who know how the internet can be used for good, in a sense, attempting to fulfill the internet's original dream. For instance, hackers in Taiwan have helped hugely with the effort to contain the coronavirus. These civic tech hacktivists, as they're called, are experimenting in radical democracy and have worked in tandem with the government's digital minister, Audrey Tang. They say that digital democracy should be fast, fair, and fun. They too have fairness as a priority and not just privacy or data protection. For many, it is a model of civic participation, which it is argued has helped contain the spread of COVID-19 in Taiwan. It is a bottom-up and highly flexible approach, unlike some of the more cumbersome top-down effects of governments in other countries. In other places, initiatives such as those in Taiwan could be augmented, could be strengthened for designing for data justice. This means that those from NGOs and policy groups, plus academics perhaps, would work with software designers and others to ensure system fairness. It also means encouraging those from the computing and software sciences to grow in their awareness and to re-engage their skills, which are tremendous, with a sense of the social, economic, and political dimensions of their expertise. Ethical computing is what I'm talking about. This will, in turn, encourage the growth of trust, if it is done in transparent and thus accountable ways. The end goal is to encourage the growth of trust and to encourage grassroots developments in data justice and also in the framing of policy, regulation, and law in ways that prioritize data justice, not only privacy and data protection. So I'll leave you with this challenge then. COVID-19 is generating lots of surveillance apps and systems, some of which I fear are not fit for purpose, and others of which actually reproduce social inequalities. And if we, the citizens, are not vigilant, some of these might become permanent features of the new coronopticon. But remember, none of this is inevitable. It does not have to be this way. And that's where we come back to the idea of the culture of surveillance. Cultures of surveillance are flexible, they're mutable, they're changing all the time as we each learn how and why we should use the internet in new ways. The new cultures of surveillance are dynamic and inventive, and such possibilities are present for simply saying no to systems that fail the tests, yes, of privacy, yes, of data protection, but more importantly, I believe, of data justice. We can encourage our computing and software friends, I speak as a social scientist, to re-engage with the real world of real people, to contribute to data justice by designing new human-centered systems, by building algorithms of care, not control, of peace, not profit. Grazie per vostra cortese attenzione.
Grazie molte al professor Lyon per questa bellissima serie di riflessioni, per questa bellissima lezione sul tema della sorveglianza. Ha ricordato anche Stefano Rodotà, che è stato un grande amico personale, ma anche un grande amico di questo tipo di riflessioni, è venuto spesso a Torino per parlare di queste cose. E mi permetto di far vedere un libro del 1973, con cui Stefano Rodotà parlava di elaboratori elettronici e di controllo sociale. Internet all'epoca era nei suoi primissimi passi, ma Stefano Rodotà aveva già capito quali erano le potenziali implicazioni dell'utilizzo di calcolatori elettronici e della raccolta dati. Quindi grazie per averlo ricordato, il professor Rodotà. Detto questo, ci sono alcune domande che arrivano tramite la chat a cui possono accedere tutti coloro che stanno seguendo questo incontro, ma prima, e adesso provo a porre due domande al professore, ma prima mi arrogo il diritto di essere io, in quanto moderatore, a porre la prima domanda. E la prima domanda, quando parliamo di data justice, è un commento alla parola stessa data justice, cioè in questo momento la trasparenza, o potremmo dire al rovescio la sorveglianza, è distribuita in maniera fortemente disuguale. Perché mentre per i singoli cittadini, per ciascuno di noi, c'è un alto livello di trasparenza, che lo vogliamo o non lo vogliamo, invece per altre entità della nostra società la trasparenza è molto minore. E in particolare mi verrebbe da dire che dopo un forte movimento di open government, quindi di governo aperto, adesso le entità che sono più opache in assoluto sono le imprese. Per cui mentre di fatto si ha una trasparenza molto grande sui cittadini e una crescente trasparenza per l'attività dell'apparato statale, le imprese continuano a rimanere fortemente opache. E questo è una distribuzione di trasparenza altamente disuguale su cui dovremmo, penso, riflettere di più e chiederci cosa possiamo fare come cittadini. Forse posso porle questa prima osservazione e poi le porrò un paio di domande che vengono dalla chat.
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's really one of the key questions that we need to be addressing. In the work that we have done over many years in the Surveillance Studies Center at Queen's University, we have frequently butted up against exactly this issue. In fact, a book that we made as a team a few years ago that's freely available online in French and English, not Italian, I don't think, is called Transparent Lives. In French, it's called Vivre à nu. And we made the book available for free online. And this was exactly the point, that the increasing transparency of ordinary populations to large governmental and corporate organizations is matched by the huge lack of transparency within those corporations and government departments. And the more that the corporations and government departments work together, the more difficult it seems to obtain transparency. And so I think to obtain transparency that would lead to accountability and therefore to appropriate regulation and policy and so on. So yeah, I agree that it's a huge problem. And I think that, you know, there are grassroots levels, and I believe that the grassroots levels are really very important. We work with such groups in Canada. We have one called Open Media. And Open Media is devoted, among other things, to making the being on the internet a fair place to be. You know, that fairness would dominate. And so there are grassroots movements that I think are really important. There are also hacker groups like the one I mentioned in the ones I mentioned in Taiwan. But there's also the need for us to press at a government policy level, which I think should be done within our democratic systems by speaking to those who are directly involved in digital affairs and showing them that there are citizens who are prepared to work with them. We have several very good members of Canadian Parliament who are engaged with just such practices. But I think it also involves us discussing this sort of thing at every level. That is to say, in senior centers where older people get together to discuss these sorts of things. We should encourage families to be engaging with each other as families, so that those with a little bit more experience can help those who are entering a digital era. And we could work online together with our children and our grandchildren. It can also be quite fun to do that sort of thing, but to help them to understand the ways in which they may be vulnerable and to see the ways in which they could contribute. And then, of course, there's a whole area of professional socialization of computer scientists, software engineers, and so on. So, and I already spoke about that in the lecture, so I won't repeat it. But I do think that we have to recognize that this is now a whole life issue. The digital isn't a separate department in our lives. It is what we are all involved in all the time. And therefore, we need to approach it at every level. There is no silver bullet. There is no single way that we can deal with this. We must be working on it at every level in everyday life. That's my response.
Grazie molte. Adesso abbiamo qualche domanda, qualche commento dall'audience, dagli spettatori che stanno seguendo. Una prima domanda è specifica sulle le app per fare il tracciamento dei contatti. E la domanda molto precisa è, a suo avviso, le tecnologie utilizzate da queste app, la loro architettura è stata plasmata da questa consapevolezza sulla privacy o semplicemente dalla decisione top down presa da Google e da Apple per le app che rispettano quel protocollo?
Yeah, good question. Thank you. The contact tracing apps, of course, come in many different shapes and forms. Towards the end of the question, Google and Apple was mentioned. And I think that from what I understand, quite strenuous efforts were made by Google and Apple to ensure that there was a high degree of security and a high degree of care taken with the ways in which the data could be collected, analyzed, and used. But it's all that data, all that the Apple and Google contributed was an API, in other words, a kind of interface, a code that would connect with Bluetooth systems and so on. So there was a limit to what that system could do. Within itself, I think it's relatively secure and a good initiative. But we still don't know exactly how the data within the that might run through the Apple Google connection may be used or abused. But you know, these contact tracing apps are very different in different places, and there are many, many questions to ask about them, as with the other technical innovations that have been developed in order to try to minimize or to combat the effects of the pandemic. And unfortunately, one sees all the usual suspects at work here. You see corporations wanting to get in on the act, just like they did after 9/11 in the United States. You see people within the universities trying to ensure that they get a little bit of the action. And unfortunately, there isn't, in many places, there isn't a coordinated approach that tries to ensure that the basic issues of what I'm calling data justice, but including within that notions of privacy, data protection, and so on and so forth, to ensure that they are really front and center. The problem is that really we're talking about human lives, and human lives are not only understood in terms of health. To live a human life, to pursue human flourishing, is to pursue a number of different things simultaneously, including freedom, including a search for equality, including so many other things. And so it isn't the case that just because there is a pandemic for which there should rightly be an urgent search for solutions or ways of mitigating the pandemic, it shouldn't be that we do not hold simultaneously to other crucial values which have to be factored in as we develop those responses.
Grazie molte. Connessa alla sua risposta c'è una domanda posta dal curatore dell'edizione italiana della cultura della sorveglianza che le pone la seguente domanda. La tensione in passato era soprattutto tra privacy e sicurezza e adesso è diventata soprattutto privacy verso salute, verso la sicurezza della nostra salute. Ma queste sono tensioni reali o è tutto molto più complicato?
Most things are always much more complicated than they seem. The book that I made that just came out in its Italian edition was really, as you are well aware, written before the pandemic. And what I was trying to do in the book was to indicate the ways in which, even in the way we define surveillance, I believe that we now have to think about it not just in the way that it has been thought of conventionally as a sort of top-down event in which surveillance is seen as the operation of some activity that is going to monitor and track the lives of individuals and so on. We have to think of surveillance in terms of not just its operations, but the experiences of surveillance. We have to think more carefully about how we are all affected and how we all participate in a world of surveillance through social media, through user-generated content. And of course, I try to argue there that user-generated content now means user-generated surveillance. That surveillance is generated by our use of the internet, our interactions, our attention, even the how long our eyes spend on any site is part of what goes into the next phase of surveillance. And so I was writing about something that just seemed to me from looking at surveillance for so many years, that although we had thought about surveillance effects and the ways in which surveillance is experienced by ordinary people in everyday life, today it is so much more so because we are all implicated. We're all involved. It isn't something that is just done in a separate silo anymore. It's something that is done across the board. Digitality in our world means surveillance. And so we have to learn how to deal with that. And so that's what I was trying to say in the book. And so in my talk today, what I was trying to do was suggest some of the lessons from the book as they might apply to the situation that we have been in since December, and especially since February and March of the pandemic. So I was simply trying to apply in what I was saying today to say that, yeah, we are clearly all affected, and it is still the case that we are all affected, and that effect is magnified by the pandemic, which I believe is generating more new forms of surveillance than even the fears of terrorism in the early 21st century did.
Grazie molte. Le faccio ancora una domanda e poi chiudiamo con un ultimo commento, sempre che proviene dalle persone che stanno seguendo. C'è una domanda relativa alla crittografia, perché continuano gli attacchi alla crittografia end-to-end, da capo a capo, cioè la crittografia che assicura, lo dico per chi ascolta, una comunicazione da un estremo all'altro della comunicazione. Ecco, come colloca la crittografia nell'ambito del discorso più ampio della data justice?
Oh, I think that end-to-end encryption is one of the key things that we should be working towards in so many other areas. And fearful governments, in democratic societies, fearful governments should not be afraid of end-to-end encryption. I mean, see the way in which the platform Zoom, which I assume is also used in Italy, grew with the pandemic. There were 10 million users of the Zoom platform in December 2019. Today, there are well over 300 million users every single day of the Zoom platform. But what has happened with Zoom is very instructive. They had been promising that their system was including end-to-end encryption over a number of months. And our users were being told that, oh yes, their data were secure. And only now, in fact, this week, I think, the FTC in the United States has been questioning Zoom about this and warning them about the fact that their claims for end-to-end encryption are simply not true. And so, and I'm sure that Zoom will respond appropriately to that. But here's the point. We all have to be vigilant all the time with questions like end-to-end encryption. We have to know what the priorities should be, and we need to be in a position where, as citizens, as well as government entities that are there to try to ensure compliance by corporations, we need to work on encouraging citizen awareness and citizen responses to these things, which are frequently so esoteric, so hard for ordinary people to understand. The technologies themselves are opaque, and the ways in which the corporations act is so often opaque. Another way, of course, is through shareholders. Shareholders are important players here. And again, shareholders who are aware of what is happening within the corporations should be speaking up. There have been many brave people within the corporations who have come out and tried to highlight what is happening within the corporations, but it requires so much effort on the part of everyone to try to be aware of what is going on and to respond appropriately. We're talking about the world that we're now creating for our grandchildren, and this is something that I think is tremendously important in all our lives, that kind of digital awareness, that kind of internet awareness that encourages all citizens, all participants to engage with others in trying to ensure that fairness, data justice, and so on are enshrined and established in the systems that we use every day of our lives.
Grazie. Un ultimo commento, Professor Lyon. C'è un commento di una persona che ha seguito questa lezione un po' scoraggiato. Dice, ormai sembra essere quindi una cultura così pervasiva, sembra che tutti quanti in un modo o nell'altro, volontariamente o meno, contribuiscano, quindi forse non c'è più nulla da fare? Questo è il commento. E se mi permette aggiungo io un'osservazione sempre su questo. Cioè, lei ha parlato di grassroots movements, quindi attività da parte dei cittadini, dei volontari e così via. È sicuramente importante, non pensa però che questi temi legati alla tecnologia e ai diritti non debbano diventare molto più profondamente politici, nel senso di diventare parte della discussione politica, dei partiti politici, in maniera molto più di quanto non capiti adesso. Prego lei la parola per l'ultima risposta.
Yes, I believe very strongly that, as I say, this should be something that we are all discussing, that we are all debating, that we are all involved in, because we are all involved in it anyway. And so, yes, I think that the political actions of grassroots activists, but as I say, at every level, we need to be thinking about this. The tech companies are particularly responsible for the ways in which we end up being fed ideas about how technology develops. We are always being given the impression that it's somehow inevitable. And we know full well that the corporations have planned their next stage of development. You know that once people have gotten used to whichever one we're up to now, iPhone 12, I think, that as soon as we've a short time has gone by, iPhone 13 will be there. The idea that there's this sort of inexorable, inevitable technological development that carries on, as it were, on its own. It does not carry on its own. It carries on as the result of direct, deliberate planning within the corporations, with the collusion with governments frequently who encourage such beliefs about the inevitability of technology. This is the lie that we need to expose. Things are not inevitable. They are the result of human actions, human choices. And we need to remember that. Of course, they have great power once they're established, but they are still the result of human choices. And human beings are active, we are intelligent, we are able to enter into these discussions and conversations. It's a lack of will that we are struggling with. If there was more will to engage with these things in an informed way, if possible, but certainly in a moral and ethical way, to discuss it at every level, in church groups, in labor unions, in families, in wherever, whatever context, this is where we should be doing it, because it's a human world that has created the internet and the kinds of surveillance that we're discussing, and it's a human world that will be able to speak to it and to continue to benefit from the good things that are there. And after all, so many people are grateful for the connections with their families and so on that are made possible by Zoom and Teams and Skype and all these other platforms. But there are ways of humanizing them, of democratizing them, and of helping those systems to be subject to the norms of the ethics of care and of data justice.
Veramente di cuore al professor David Lyon per questa splendida lezione, per questa conversazione. Siamo veramente grati del suo contributo a Biennale Tecnologia e speriamo di poter continuare questa interazione anche in futuro. Grazie, professore.
Grazie, molto grazie.